From shame and shadow recast, in black and gold reborn. Part 1. Devils and Dust. Chapter 1. The Sorcerer and the Machine. In the long years before the Battle of Canticle City, I knew no fear because I had nothing to lose. Everything I'd treasured was dust at the mercy of history's winds. Every truth I'd fought for was now nothing more than idle philosophy, spoken by exiles, whispered by ghosts. None of this angered me, nor was I victim to any special melancholy. I'd learned over the centuries that only a fool tried to fight fate. All that remained were the nightmares. My somnolent mind took a dark joy in casting back to Judgment Day, when wolves howled and ran through the burning city streets. I dreamed the same dream each time I allowed myself to sleep. Wolves. Always the wolves. Adrenaline pulled me from slumber on a lactic leash, leaving my hands trembling and my skin dusted in cold crystals of sweat. Dream howls followed me back to the waking world, fading into the metal walls of my meditation cell. Some nights I felt those howls in my blood, riding through my veins, imprinted in my genetic coding. The wolves, even though they were nothing more than memory, hunted with an eagerness fiercer than fury. I waited for them to melt away into the thrumming sounds of the ship all around. Only then did I rise. The chronometer cited that I'd slept for almost 3 hours. After remaining awake for 13 days, even a clutch of stolen hours' rest was a welcome respite. On the deck floor of my modest bedchamber, a wolf that wasn't a wolf lay in watchful repose. Her white eyes, as featureless as perfect pearls, tracked me as I stood. When the beast rose a moment later, her movements were unnaturally fluid, not bound to the motions of natural muscle. She didn't move the way real wolves moved, nor even as the wolves that haunted my dreams. She moved like a ghost wearing a wolf's skin. The nearer one came to the creature, the less she resembled a natural beast at all. Her claws and teeth were glassy and black. Her mouth was dry of any saliva, and she never blinked. She smelt not of flesh and fur, but of the smoke that follows fire, the undeniable scent of a murdered homeworld.
"Master,"
came the wolf's thought. It wasn't really a word, it was a concept, an acknowledgement of submission and affection. However, a human and post-human mind instinctively processes such things as language. "Gaia," I sent back in telepathic greeting.
"You dream too loud," she told me. "I fed well that day. The last breaths of the Fenrisborn, the crack of white bones for the tangy marrow within, the salty tongue sting of the proudest blood."
Her amusement inspired my own. Her confidence was always infectious.
"Kaon,"
came a dull, inhuman voice from all around the chamber, a voice wholly starved of both emotion and gender.
"We know you are awake."
"I am," I assured the empty air. Gaia's dark fur was soft beneath my fingertips. It felt almost real. The beast paid no heed as I scratched behind its ears, showing neither pleasure nor irritation.
"Come to us, Kaon."
I wasn't sure I could deal with such a meeting just then. "I cannot. Ashur Kai needs me."
"We are recording tonal signifiers suggesting deception in your reply, Kaon."
"Oh, that is because I am lying to you." No reply. I took that as a good thing. "Has there been any word regarding power through the antechambers connected to the spinal thoroughfares?"
No recorded changes, the voice assured me.
A shame, but not a surprise, given the ship's power conservation. I rose from the slab that served as my pallet, thumbing my sore eyes in the wake of unsatisfying slumber. The chamber's illumination was dull with the Talok's depleted power, mirroring the years I'd spent as a Tizcan child reading parchments by handheld illume globe. Tizga, once called the City of Light. The last time I had seen the city of my birth was when I'd fled from it, watching Prospero burn as the planet receded on the Oculus viewscreen. Atisca still lived after a fashion, on the Legion's new homeworld of Sortiarius. I'd visited it a handful of times, deep in the eye, yet never felt any compunction to remain there. Many of my brothers felt the same, at least those few with their minds still intact. In those inglorious days, the Thousand Suns were a divided brotherhood at best. At worst, they'd forgotten what it meant to be brothers at all. As for Magnus, the Crimson King, who once held court above his sons, our father was lost in the ebb and flow of the great game, fighting the war of the four gods. His concerns were etheric and ethereal, while his son's ambitions were still mortal and mundane. All we wanted to do was survive. Many of my brothers sold their lore and war sorcery to the highest bidders amongst the warring legions. Our talents were always in demand. Sortiarius was a hostile home, even among the myriad worlds bathed in the energies of the eye. All who dwelled there lived beneath a burning sky that stole all notion of night and day, with the heavens drowned in a swirling, tormented chorus of the restless dead. I had seen Saturn in the same planetary system as Terra, then the planet Kalmasar, orbiting the white sun Clovo. Both planets are haloed with rings of rock and ice, marking them out from their celestial brethren. Sortiarius had a similar ring, spectrally white against the tumultuous violet of ice space. It was formed not from ice or rock, but from shrieking souls. The Thousand Suns exile world was quite literally crowned by the howling spirits of those who had died by deceit. It was beautiful in its own way.
"Come to us," said the mechanical voice from the wall-mounted vox speakers.
Was I imagining the faint edge of a plea in the dead tone? It unnerved me, though I couldn't say why.
"I would rather not."
I moved to the door and didn't need to tell Gaia to follow. The black wolf padded after me, white eyes watching, obsidian claws clicking and scratching along the deck. Sometimes, if you glanced at the right moment, Gaia's shadow against the wall was something tall and horned and winged. Other times, my she-wolf cast no shadow at all. Two guardians stood vigil outside my door. Both were clad in bronze-edged cobalt ceramite, with their helms marked by high Keltaran headcrests, reminiscent of Prosperine history and the ancient Ashtic Gipton empires of old Earth. Both of them turned their heads towards me, just as expected. One of them even nodded in slow greeting, solemn as any temple gargoyle. Once this display of life would have teased me with the threat of false hope, but I was beyond such delusions now. My kindred were long gone, slain by Ahriman's hubris. These rubrici, these husks of ashen undeath, stood in their place. Mekari, Jeddor, I greeted them by name, futile as it was.
Kaon,
Mekari managed to project the name, but it was a thing of cold and simple obedience, not true recognition.
Dust, said Jeddor. He'd been the one to nod. All is dust.
My brothers, I sent back to the rubrici. Looking upon them with the penetrative stare of second sight was maddening, for I saw both life and death in the ceramite husks they had become. I reached for them, not physically, but with a hesitant pressure of psychic awareness. It was the same subtle straining one might do to listen for a distant voice on a silent night. I felt the nearness of their souls, no different from when they'd walked among the living. But within their armour was nothing but ash. Within their minds was mist instead of memory. From Jeddor, I sensed the scarcest ember of recollection, a flash of white flame eclipsing all else, lasting no more than a moment. That was how Jeddor had died, how the whole Legion had died, in rapturous fire. Although Mekari's mind sometimes offered the same insignificant pulse of remembrance, I sensed nothing from him then. The latter Rubrikai regarded me with an emotionless stare of its helm's T-visor, clutching its bolter in stately guardianship. On more than one occasion, I had tried to explain the living-dead contradiction to Nefertari, but the right words always failed me. The last time we'd spoken of it, it had ended particularly poorly. "They are there and not there," I'd said to her. "Husks, shadows. I cannot explain it to someone without the second sight. It is like trying to describe music to someone born deaf." At the time, Nefertari had run her clawed gauntlet down Mekhari's helm, her crystal nails scraping over one staring red eye lens. Her skin was whiter than milk, paler than marble, translucent enough to show faint cobwebs beneath the skin of her angular cheeks. She looked half-dead herself.
"You explain it," she had replied with a dry alien smile, "by saying that music is the sound of emotion expressed through art from musician to audience."
I had nodded at her elegant rebuttal, but said nothing more. The details of my brother's curse weren't something I enjoyed sharing, even with her, not least because I shared the blame for their fate. I was the one who had tried to stop Ahriman's last throw of the dice. I was the one who had failed. The familiar throb of guilt-stained irritation pulled me back to the present. Gaia growled by my side. "Follow," I bade the two Rubrikai. The command cracked down the psychic filament, linking the three of us, and the bond thrummed with their acknowledgement. Mekhari and Jeddor's boot steps thudded on the decking as they trailed behind. In the long thoroughfare leading to the bridge, another vox speaker crackled to life.
"Come to us," it said.
Another toneless entreaty to venture deeper into the ship's cold hallways. I looked directly at one of the bronze aural receptors dotting the arched walls of the main spinal corridor. This one was forged in the shape of a smiling, androgynous burial mask.
"Why?"
I asked it. The confession was whispered from speakers all over the ship, just another voice among the songs of ghosts.
"Because we are lonely."
Life aboard the Talok was a thing of contrast and contradiction, as with all Imperial vessels cast onto the shores of Hell. Realms of stability and tormented currents existed throughout the Great Eye, and the ships that sailed inside Eye Space eventually settled into similar states of infrequent flux. It's a realm where thought becomes reality if one has the willpower necessary to bring forth something from the warp's nothingness. If a mortal yearns for something, the warp will often provide it, though rarely without unexpected cost. Once the weakest souls killed themselves with an inability to control their wayward imaginations, structure among the crew began to rise from the disordered rubble. Within the Talok's arched halls, society soon reformed around an oppressive meritocracy. Those who were most useful to me rose above those who were not. It was that simple. Many of our crew were human, taken as slaves in raids during the Legion Wars. Beneath them were the servitors, and above them were the bestial mutants harvested from the genetic stock of Sortiarius. The braying of their ritual battles echoed down the halls night after night, as they did battle on lower decks that stank of beasts' fur and animals' sweat. It took almost 2 hours to reach the Amanesis. 2 hours of bulkheads slowly grinding open on low power. 2 hours of juddering ascent, descent platforms. 2 hours of dark corridors and the sound of warp song torturing the ship's metal bones. Through the unmelody of straining creaks, infrequent shivers coursed through Talok's predatory form as the ship split the eye's densest tides. Outside, a storm raged. Rare were the times we needed to reactivate the Geller field within the eye, but this region was more warp than reality, and an ocean of demons burned in our wake. I paid no heed to the warp's tune. Others among our warband claimed to hear voices in the harshest storms, the voices of allies and enemies, of betrayers and the betrayed. I heard no such thing. No voices, at least. Gaia trailed us, occasionally vanishing into the shadows on the whim of whatever hunts tempted her. My wolf would enter a spread of darkness and emerge elsewhere from another shadow. Each time she melted into nothingness, I'd feel a resonant shiver through the unseen bond that bound us together. In contrast, Mekari and Jeddor stalked behind in mute compliance. I took a solemn solace in their company. They were a stalwart presence, if not gifted conversationalists. Sometimes I found myself speaking to them as though they were still alive, discussing my plans with them and replying to their stoic silence as if they'd actually answered. I wondered what my still-breathing kindred would make of my behaviour back on Sortiarius, and whether any of the other 1,000 sun survivors were guilty of the same indulgence. The deeper we walked through the ship, the less it resembled a melancholy fortress, and the closer it came to a slum. Machinery became more ramshackle, and attending humans ever more wretched. They bowed as I passed. Some wept. Some scattered like vermin before the light. They all knew better than to speak to me. I bore them no special hatred, but the hive swarm of their thoughts made them unpleasant to be near. They lived meaningless lives in the dark, born and living and dying as slaves to masters they could not comprehend in a war they didn't understand. Disease ravaged the lower decks in cycles of plague. Most of our slave raids were for simple mass replenishment of unskilled labor. But once every few decades, we would need to strike against another legion to restock the crew decks in the wake of another eye-borne contagion. The Eye of Terror was unkind to the powerless and the weak of will. When I reached the great linked chambers of the outer core, the Anamnesis's eroding sense of order began to take over. The vast halls were populated by servitors and robed cultists of the machine god, all dealing with the clanking machinery that lined the walls and ceilings and nestled in pits cut into the floors. Here was the Talok's brain laid bare, its veins formed of composite cables and twinned wires, its meat made of decaying black steel engines and rusting iron generators. The monotasked work crews largely ignored their master's passage, though their cultist overseers bowed and scraped, much as the human herd did on the decks above. I sensed their reluctance to bow before any authority that didn't share their worship of the Omnissiah, but I was not unkind to them. By remaining here, they were allowed to serve the needs of the Amanesis itself, and that was an honour coveted by many in the machine cult. A few managed to offer genuinely respectful gestures of submission in acknowledgement when they registered me as the ship's commander. Their respect was meaningless, nor was I concerned with those who lacked it. Unlike the unskilled human menials, who also lived their sunless lives in the ship's bowels, these priests had more pressing duties than prostrating themselves before a lord who paid them little heed in kind. I let them work in peace, and they accorded me the same polite ignorance. Rising above the hunched priests and shambling servitors were several robotic sentinels, humanoid thalaxi, and Baharat-class cybernetic warriors in each chamber. All of them stood motionless, with their heads lowered and weapons slung. As with the servitors, the inactive robots made no note of our passing from the outer core to the inner. The inner core was a lone vault shielded behind a series of sealed bulkheads, accessible only by the highest-ranking souls on the ship. Automated laser turrets cycled into reluctant life, sliding from wall housings on crunching mechanisms and tracking our approach across the gantry deck. I doubted more than half of them still had the power to fire, but it was reassuring to see the machine spirit controlling the Talok still upheld certain standards. The doorway to the inner core was almost palatial in ostentation. The doors themselves were great slabs of dark metal engraved with the sinuous, coiling forms of Prosperine serpents, their crested heads held high, their jaws wide to devour twin suns. The only guardian here was another Baharat automaton, 4 meters of mechanical muscle and metallic might, armed with rotor cannons on its shoulders. Unlike those of the outer core, this one remained active. Its joints still exhaled piston breath, its weapon mounts hummed with live charge. The cyborg's featureless faceplate regarded me in emotionless judgment, before stalking aside on heavy iron foot claws. It didn't speak. Almost nothing spoke down here. Everything communicated in blurts of scrambled machine code, when vocalization was required at all. I pressed a hand to one of the immense sculptures. My palm covered only a single scale on the left serpent's hide, and projected a momentary pulse of thought beyond the sealed gateway. I am here. With a discordant orchestra of slamming lock bars and rattling machinery, the first of the 7 bulkheads began the arduous process of opening. A machine spirit is the incarnation of that most precious of unions, the literal bond between mankind and the machine god. To the tech priests of the Martian Mechanicum, that purer, worthier institute predating the hide-bound Adeptus Mechanicus, there is no more sacred state of being than this divine merging. Most machine spirits are nevertheless crude, limited things, formed of chosen biological components kept alive in a synthetic chemical stew, then slave-linked to the systems they will spend eternity operating at the behest of inloaded programming. In an empire where artificial intelligence is unrivaled heresy, the creation of machine spirits keeps the vital human spirit at the core of any automated process. At the commonly held peak of this technology are the war machines of the Space Marine Legions and the Martian cults, allowing warriors to fight on past mutilation and death within the armored shell of a cybernetic warlord. At the more mundane end of the spectrum are the targeting assistance arrays of battle tanks and gunships, right through to the secondary cognition engines of city-sized warships sailing the void. But other templates exist, other variations on the theme. Not every invention is created equal. I am here, I sent beyond the door. I sensed the machine spirit's biological components twisting in their tank of cold aqua vitrilio, as it sent its reply through a series of enslaved system functions. A moment later, the doorways of the inner core started the rituals of unlocking. The entity at the ship's heart, known as the Amanesis, was waiting. She was very good at that. Cease, I sent to my brothers in wordless command. Makari and Jeddor stopped moving at once, bolters cradled low. Kill anyone that seeks entry. An unnecessary order. No one would make it into the inner core without the Amanesis allowing it. But I was gratified by the hesitant psychic acknowledgement that echoed from whatever spectral remnant animated Jeddor's armor. Makari was still silent. I wasn't concerned by his silence. These things came and went, like irregular tides. With the order given, both of the Rubrikai warriors turned back to face the last doorway, raising their bolters and taking aim. There they stood, silent and unmoving, loyal beyond the grave.
Kahan,
the Amanesis greeted me. She was more than many machine spirits, more at least than a platter of organs in an amniotic tank. The Anamnesis hadn't endured vivisection before being consigned to her fate. She was almost whole, floating nude in her wide, tall tank of aqua vitrilio. Her shaven head was connected to the chamber's hundreds of machines by a gorgon's crown of thick cables implanted into her skull. Her skin, in sunlight, had been the colour of caramel. In this chamber, and inside her liquid tomb, time had paled her flesh considerably. Secondary brains, some synthetically engineered, others taken by force from the still-living bodies of their unwilling donors, were cradled in seed-like generator housings, attached like leeches to the sides of her containment tank. Purifiers hummed beneath her cradle of reinforced glass, cleansing and replenishing her cold fluid. She was, for all intents and purposes, a young adult female locked in an artificial womb, trading true life for immortality in icy fluid. She saw with the Talok's Auspex scanners. She fought by firing its cannons. She thought with the hundreds of secondary brains enslaved to her own, turning her into a gestalt entity far beyond her former humanity. "Are you well?" I asked her. The Anamnesis floated to the front of her tank, looking out at me with dead eyes. Her hand pressed to the glass palm out, as though she could touch my armour, but the absence of all life in her stare robbed the moment of any affection.
"We function," she replied.
The machine spirit's voice inside the inner core was a soft, androgynous tone, no longer shrouded in crackles of vox corruption. It manifested from the mouths of 14 ivory gargoyles, 7 leering from the north wall, 7 leering from the south. They were sculpted to be clawing their way from the walls, emerging through the labyrinth of cables and generators that turned the inner core into an industrial cityscape.
"We see 2 of your dead men."
"Oh, it's Mikari and Jeddor." That made her lips twitch.
"We knew them before."
Then she looked down at the wolf, who had emerged from the shadows cast by one of the whining generators.
"We see Gaia."
The beast sat on its haunches, watching her in its unwolfish way. Its eyes were the same pearlescent hue as the amniotic fluid that supported the machine spirit's body. I dragged my gaze from the unhealthy pallor of the girl's face, pressing my hand to the glass in reflection of her greeting. As always, I reached for her on instinct, and sensed nothing beyond the insectile buzz of the million cogitations taking place in her gestalt mind. But she'd smiled at the mention of Mikari and Jeddor, and that made me cautious. She shouldn't have smiled. The Anamnesis never smiled. Caution gave way to that most treacherous of temptations, hope. Could the smile have meant more than a flicker of muscle memory?
"Tell me something," I began.
The Anamnesis remained focused on Gaia as the maiden drifted through the milky murk.
"We know what you will ask," she said.
"I should have asked before now. But with the dream of wolves fresh in my thoughts, I am less inclined towards my usual patience and self-delusion." She allowed herself a nod, another unnecessarily human gesture.
"We wait for the question."
"I want the truth."
"We do not lie," she answered at once.
"Because you choose not to lie, or because you can't lie?"
"Irrelevant. The result is the same. We do not lie."
"You smiled just now, when I told you I was with Mikari and Jeddor." Dead-eyed, she still stared.
An unrelated motor response from our biological components. A twist of muscle and sinew. Nothing more.
My hand against the glass formed a slow fist. Just tell me. Tell me if there's anything left of her inside you. Anything at all. She turned in the fluid, a ghost in the fog whispering from the chamber's speakers. Her eyes were a shark's eyes, with the same blunt and selfish soullessness.
We are the anamnesis, she said at last. We are one from many. The she you seek is merely the dominant percentage of our biological component cluster. The she you remember holds no stronger role in our cognitive matrix than any other mind.
I said nothing. Just met her eyes.
We registered the emotive responses of sorrow on your features, Kaon.
All is well. Thank you for the answer.
She chose this, Kaon. She volunteered to become the anamnesis.
I know. The anamnesis pressed her hand to the glass again, her palm against my fist, separated by the dense glass.
We have caused you emotional harm.
I've never been a good liar. The talent evaded me since birth. Even so, I hope the false smile would deceive her. You exaggerate my attachment to mortal concerns, I replied. I was merely curious.
We register your voice pattern indicating a significant emotional investment in this matter.
Well, that turned my smile more sincere. I couldn't help but wonder why her mechanicum creators gave her the capacity to analyze such things. Do not exceed your mandate, Amnesis. Fly the ship and leave my concerns to me.
We will obey.
She turned in the fluid again. Cables and wires connected to her shaven head streamed out in mechanical mimicry of hair. Somehow she looked almost hesitant.
We repeat our request for conversational exchange,
she stated with bizarrely feminine politeness. I paced the chamber, my footfalls silent in the muted growls of the machine spirit's life support engines. What would you like to speak of? I asked, circling her glass prison. She drifted with me, following my movements.
We wish only to communicate. The subject is irrelevant. Speak, and we shall listen. Tell a tale, an anecdote, a report, a story.
You've heard all my stories.
We have not. Not all. Tell us of Prospero. Tell us when darkness came to the City of Light.
You were there.
We bore witness to the aftermath. We felt none of the moment's immediacy. We were not running through the streets with a bolter in our hands.
I closed my eyes as the howls broke free of my dreams and chased me even here, to this chamber. Across the deck, Gaia made a throaty sound that seemed an alloy of a snarl and a chuckle. No matter how much I had lost with the fall of my birth world, the wolf remembered it differently. As she was so fond of reminding me, Gaia had fed very well that day. Another time, perhaps.
We recognize that your voice pattern...
Enough, please, Itzara. I don't care about my voice pattern. She stared as she always stared, a paradox of dead eyes and disconcerting focus. As I met her gaze, I caught sight of my own wraith-like reflection in the glass wall of her tank, an image of white robes and dusky skin. A boy born of a hot world and swollen with archaeogenetic ingenuity to become a weapon of war. The anamnesis floated closer, both hands against the glass now, her mouth slack in the murk. Nothing about her looked alive.
Do not address us by that name, she said. The she of that name is now one of the many. We are not Itzara. We are the anamnesis.
I know.
We no longer desire your presence, Kaon.
You have no authority over me, machine.
She didn't reply.
As she floated in her tideless fluid, her face cocked as if heeding a distant voice, her fingertips lifted from the glass, stroking several of the cables socketed into her bare head.
What is it? I asked.
You are needed.
She looked into my eyes, and for a moment it seemed she would smile again. No such expression manifested. Her fey stare continued unabated.
We hear the alien's cries, she said. She screams for your presence across the Vox. But you are here, bare of armor, and do not answer.
What does she require of me? I asked, though I could guess the answer. The alien had shown incredible strength resisting it for this long.
She thirsts, the anamnesis replied.
Again, the flicker in her eyes of something that never quite became emotion. The edge of discomfort, perhaps? Or the shadow of disgust? Or, as she claimed, mere muscle memory.
Do you wish to communicate with her?
And say what? No. Seal the eerie. Lock her inside. There was no pause, no hesitation. The anamnesis didn't even blink.
It is done.
In the stillness that followed, I looked into the anamnesis's passive eyes. Activate my arming servitors, please. I need my armor.
It is done, she replied. We are cognizant of Nefertari's usefulness. Thus, we ask if you plan to kill her.
What? Of course not. What kind of man do you think I am?
We do not think you are a man at all, Gaon. We think you are a weapon with lingering traces of humanity. Now go to your alien, Iskandar Kaon. She needs you.
I turned to leave, but not to go to my blood ward, to arm myself and prepare for the fleet muster, to let Nefertari lie in the dark a while longer.